Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning. I think Honourable Kamala is the only one who's laughing because it's meant to be a joke. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's not a joke. I was just congratulating the boys that they are too early today. The boys' choir is already in their seat.
I know, and that's why they've started to sing their own tune there. That's what's worrying me. And you've had to come like the woman to set the pace here. Apologies to my many, many honourable male members. Always remember, I do have a son and a husband, so you are well represented in the family. I also more officially wish to congratulate Honourable Smuller on achieving, I were not yet sure of his age, but it is his birthday, which is a wonderful day to have. Being born, you join the human race. Happy birthday. I said I would like to think of bringing along a cake sometime, but I'll save that for when we're closer to Johannesburg and my kitchen. Now, just on a few other matters, and of course the department is very welcome. Probably members of the parliamentary.
I'm with PMG.
PMG.
Yeah.
When all else fails, you have the records, I believe.
I hope so.
So we don't want to lose you. And then, of course, Ms. Naidu. Let us just come back to one or two things. I seldom have a long opening, but because I will be leaving as the representative of Parliament on PALMED, just at the annual general meeting, to make sure your health remains financially resourced, I'll be leaving at just after 11 to attend that annual meeting. I don't have a choice. I want to put this in now.
Hey, before we proceed, let's wish all the fathers the belated Father's Day. Let's not seem to be jealous as mothers. Let's just say to all of them, happy belated Father's Day.
Indeed, indeed. What would we do without our men? And our fathers. A family without a father, certainly, or a father figure, certainly got something missing there. Yes, I hope your families gave you a happy Father's Day and treasures you. You are to be treasured. Thank you, Honourable Kamala. The opening here should also include three other things. The one is the fact that as soon as we have a quorum, I wish to see passed the report on the IAF Congress in Prague, which we've delayed while the Honourable Alberts was in Geneva. Do you recall that? I mean, we've all read it, but you weren't there to know if these are the facts. Honourable Kwabasa and myself have been here. So that has to be done as soon as we have eight, either Honourable Kotsi or Honourable Khadebi. The other issue is gambling. Gambling's been very much like the pregnancy of an elephant, one of the longest in the animal kingdom. And we finally now have given birth, so we now have the... But as with the elephants, as Africans know, now that we have this commission review, we're able now to embark on something we left in 2009, when the very first thing that landed on our desk was the gambling. We did an intensive deliberation oversight on the secondary legislation and came to the conclusion, as you will see reflected in the then report, that we may may well need to amend the Principal Act for three reasons. One, it's been more than 10 years since this came into operation. It started off, let's just regulate something we is around, and, you know, horse racing is the so-called royal game, but, you know, there are other forms. Let's just regulate this. It's all on let's just regulate. Suddenly it came to let's just revenue it. You know, the R was the only thing in common. And let's just get as much money as we can, as fast as we can, in every province. And suddenly, it changed its character. And so everyone was just thinking, how do we raise funds? How do we raise funds? Gambling, casinos, you know, and this sort of thing. And you had key people begging for casinos long before they were begging for a soup kitchen. So, you know, I don't know. We then said, look, we've got to look now what the social impact or social pathology, what is it? We're not going to say, let's just close this down. We all know with some things, regulation is just the best policy. So that is the short background to it. Because it would seem as if we, my apologies, and I always, where is this thing? Just turn that off, please. You know, we got this back, and I think you got copies, didn't you, of this, yes. And I said, we're not doing it this term per se, this session right now, but we need to begin to look at it. The minister this morning, I received from him a letter, you know, which he did discuss with me yesterday, verbally and so on, indicating, look, what is our view? It sounded like really the committee was looking along the lines of the principle, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe this should be formally tabled. I said, yes. Then, of course, we can hold public hearings. Do you follow? To now just hold public hearings would be very difficult because we need to write several letters. It goes through other processes. Whereas this way, we now have immediate authority. Would you see that? Do we agree? Yes, fine. We'll get that again passed when the quorum comes. So I'm not reading it because I've handed it up to you. Haven't you all got a copy? Now, I've just handed it, well, I asked for it to be handed out. It's just come in this morning. All right. So, I don't even think the staff have one. There we are. You know, it's fresh off the press. Are we all right? So, you can study it at your leisure over tea. Then, the last little item here that we needed to tackle was the oversight will just once again be handed to you. And I just need you to keep in mind that we will thoroughly discuss this next Wednesday. Just want, so don't start panicking, well, I never got a chance to speak on it and say anything. The dates will have to be confirmed, though. And so will the dates of the task team for IP, you know, that kind of thing. So you'll need that today just to adopt. But with respect to that, we were going to think of sand and zirconium and running out there on perhaps some donkeys because there isn't anything that gets there. But I believe the minister was telling me when I asked about this, because I was surprised he wasn't even a railhead or something just yet. And he said, no, at the moment it's a concept and it is happening. They're busy establishing the mine. So I thought it advisable, and I haven't even said this to Manco, the study trip, but the minister just mentioned that. No, unless we want to be part of the prospecting bunch, you know, it really wouldn't be helpful to do it this year. All right, so that I'm saying it won't be here. So although you will see it on the oversight thing, I'm telling you why it's not going to be considered. Now, having done the longest opening in 3 years, may we have apologies, please? Oh, there's one more thing. The training is not on here. And I said, would Honourable Kwabasa give you like a 2-minute taste and Honourable Albert's a 2-minute taste or 1 minute? Because 1 minute, I see parties can speak at length. So, you know, in the half. So I'm sure 1 minute is sufficient. And then next week, you will already have either today or Tuesday a written document, and then it'll be on next week. Is that all right for two of you? Right. Honourable Albert, you'll be all ready to fire on us joining the Geneva grouping, huh? Right, thank you. All right, now, only at that point are we moving to apologies, please.
We've received apologies from Ms. Sue van der Merwe, who is currently travelling overseas, as well as Mr. Tim Harris. And we also receive apology from Mr. Mpashlele, who is unable to attend due to party commitments, and also of Ms. Lavenia, who is unable to attend due to ill health. We also receive an apology from Ms. Kotsi, who will be arriving later on about 10, because she has a doctor's appointment. Thank you.
Those are the apologies. Having said that, we said that we would, Honourable Whip, Debbie, pass the IAF report as soon as we got the quorum. And the reason for that is, as you will know, I've been deployed by Parliament to represent them on Parmed, and the annual general meeting starts at 11 today. So I'll be down there at 11:15. So if you don't mind, can I now ask you to pick up the IAF? Remember, I did mention that would come in at any point. And we just, and in particular, would you please look at the recommendations? I'll leave you for a minute to look at them. In particular, Honourable Elvis, you must check that. While members are just reading that, can I have a quick word with the DG, please? Indicate to our whip, who will be chairing, Honourable Hadebi, that I am assured that the department really only needs an hour, or 45 minutes to 50 minutes to do both, and then we'll still have time for deliberations then, okay. we managed to bite this because it has been issued now for a month, these things, before elections. Although I know we were not thinking of space at the time. Yes, at any time you think you're ready, Honourable Elders, that you are the critical one, I think Honourable Kobasa, I believe, has familiarized himself. I'm saying that, but, you know, I get a nod. Right. Have you familiarized yourself?
Yes, Chair, the report looks good. I just want to add something in recommendations. I'm not sure if it truly will fit, but I think it's important, considering IPAP and the technology path we're looking at, that we also recommend that focus be placed on technology training, skills transfer for future development of skills in the space industry and science industry in general.
You kindly draft it, although I think members have got the gist. Have we got the gist, members, honourable members? And I think the point is, do we agree? Is there anyone who disagrees with that? The skills, you know. Right, okay. Having got that, I know that Honourable Alberts will just draft something so that it absolutely captures. On the basis of that, can I ask the committee secretary to propose, go through the process of proposing and... Yes.
The report has been tabled, and we must ask for a seconder and a mover for this report to be adopted by the committee.
A mover. It should preferably be someone who went to move it, you see.
Advocate Albert moves for the adoption of the report. Can we have a seconder for the adoption?
You've got it. Honourable Kobasa and Honourable Khadebe. I think that's it. Honourable Khadebe, do you wish to add something?
No, Chair, before I can agree that this report be adopted, we must go to page 4. Go to page 4. And then on the first paragraph, the eruption of the islands, what volcano? If those people went there, can they pronounce that with this? And then I agree to the report.
We didn't actually go there. And I guess it's one of these empowerment issues that we must take up. But it's not so difficult to pronounce. I think the spelling puts one off. Because I remember hearing it repeatedly and it never looked like this. Do you recall, DG, how it was pronounced? Because you were in Europe at the time. You know, the fact that, who was it, the German, sort of commercial airline, was that Lufthansa was the only one with the kind of military experience to fly through the ash or something. I don't know if your aircraft double up as military jets or something, but...
I'm sorry about that. I think you must just accept,
Honourable Khadebe, that... Honourable Alberts has proposed this, and it's been seconded. You indicated you would share your seconding, and I will make a personal intervention there to ensure I learn how to pronounce it, and then come back next Wednesday to say it to you. But can our secretary ensure that the spelling is correct? Because I don't recall it looking like this in any of our newspapers. Do you? Right, no, we don't. Thank you. So now we're going to go straight from that intriguing spelling into the briefing that the department flew down for, among other things, I believe, the briefing on regulations with respect to the Companies Act and Consumer Protection Act. And I would ask the DG, Mr. October, of course, to to lead us and lead his team.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Firstly, let me just take this opportunity to thank the committee. As you know, our Deputy Director General Zodwa Ntuli, when she was in Cape Town, had to be rushed to hospital. So she's still in hospital in Cape Town, and she's been there for about a week now. And I just wanted to thank the committee for their best wishes and for the visits they have paid to Ms. Ntuli on that. Then this,
can I just interrupt you there? You will recall we did take that resolution in committee. Unfortunately, we hadn't yet accessed the chairperson's fund, but I was quite happy on your behalf to learn that the DG, when I visited, had about 6 bowls of flowers and several sprays and realized she could be overpowered, you know, by another bowl. And so I asked what she would like, and she said a 90, because, you see, she came down without those necessities. And I'm not going to take it out of the chairperson's fund. It will be the equivalent of a cake out of my pocket. But I did, on the card, indicate that this had come from the entire committee and that we had taken a resolution. So she was aware of that, and it was just that June the 16th had kept you away from her. Thank you.
Yes, no, thanks for the to the committee members for that. As you indicated, what we're dealing with is the regulations of the Companies and Consumer Act. Now, Madam Chair, let me say at the start, we're dealing here with secondary or subordinate legislation here, which is really third-tier legislation. As you know, the overarching law is the Constitution, and then you have the primary legislation, which is what you are responsible for, and then the regulations is what the minister is responsible for. And so the process that we followed, we've issued this regulations already. In the Consumer Act, we issued the regulations in April, and in the Companies Act, we issued the regulations in May. Now, as per the law, we have to give allow 30 days for comment before the regulations are final. Now, just that's why I'll take you through the presentation, but the 30 days has already expired, so the regulations are now in force, as it were. And as I indicated, so this is really a briefing on what those regulations are about, but they've already been issued. The private sector and companies are, and consumers are already using and acting in terms of these regulations. As I indicated, the regulations are of a technical nature. The policy intent is reflected in the main legislation, in the Act itself. The minister can only give effect to the intention of the legislature in the regulation. So there's full consistency between the regulations and the Act, but it just provides technical detail on how to implement the Act. So I'll take you very through, and I'll ask the experts, my colleagues here, if there's anything you require more detail on, then we can expand on it. Other than that, I'll go through it very very quickly. Just on the process, now, usually one follows these steps in process, that you have the legislation, and then thereafter the minister issues the regulations. Because of the complexity of this, of the Companies Act and the Consumer Act, we did extensive consultation on the regulations itself, and we did it simultaneously with the drafting of the Act itself. And so there was an intense period of bilateral consultations with business organizations, with the accounting authorities, with the JSE, but there was a period of 2-3 years consultations on the regulations itself. So that's why when we issued the regulations, it was nothing new for people. They've seen it. It's been around for, as I said, for 2 years, and so on. Now, the reason we went into this process of simultaneous, the legislation and the regulations running simultaneously,
Of course, because the Companies Act affects each and every company in South Africa, so that's really such an essential piece of legislation that we had to ensure that the regulations are absolutely consistent with the main act itself, and that's why this process was run. So, but all I can say is that, as you know, the exhaustive processes of the Companies Act, there was as an exhaustive process on the regulations itself, and so on. And that's why one can see that on the whole, while people have to work quite hard on it, people are currently implementing the regulation and acting in terms of it. So what does the regulations deal with? These are some of the technical issues, as I indicated, in terms of the Companies Act. It deals with how, what must be in your accounting records. It deals with how you report your financial statements. It deals with how and by whom companies can be audited. It deals with how you deal with your annual returns. It deals with business risk, and it deals with a big issue you're familiar with, is the par value shares issue. And it deals with the different forms that you have to fill in. So that's, as I said, it's very technical. It's just detail, and these are the issues it deals with. Firstly, on the accounting records, as you know, the main aim of the legislation there was to ensure that we have proper transparency in terms of the accounting practices of companies. Because as you know, if you deal with a company and you're going to enter into contracts with it, you must understand that that company, when it says it is financially viable, it is so, and it reports properly on the key, let's say, financial variables and financial indicators. And that's why there needs to be a regulation which lays out exactly what a company must submit when it registers. So the form there provides the details of what information is required. For example, must specify its registered head office. It must provide information on the directors, their ID numbers, their details, and so on. So, as I said, the accounting records. So the regulation merely specifies to a company what information it must provide in order to be registered. Similarly, with financial statements, it sets out what are the different requirements that companies must meet with regard to what they report. Now, as you know, there's a difference in reporting. For example, if you're a listed public company, you must, for example, have a complete audited statement which sets out in detail your financial relationships. If you if you're a state-owned company, again, the requirements are quite high. You have to meet the requirements of the private sector or the PFMA if you're a state-owned entity, and so on. So, as I said, this is part of transparency and part of ensuring that there is more stringent financial reporting standards on bigger companies and less stringent on smaller companies. But as I said, those forms then spell that out to it. The other part the regulations deal with is the auditing of companies. Now, firstly, there's a distinction between, if you're a listed company, if you're a state-owned enterprise, you have to be audited by a registered or authorized auditor. Other than that, you can, for example, then if you're a smaller company, you can do it yourself, or you can have what we call later on an independent review. So, for example, independent review is, let's say, less onerous, less expensive, less cumbersome than a full audit. And so what this regulation lays out is what standards you must meet, and that ISRE is the international standard for independent reviews. So, as I indicated, the regulations lay out the three ways in which you report on your financial position. That is, you can, some companies have a proper audit, others can do it themselves internally, or you can do it via independent review process. Then the regulations also lay out how do we deal with the annual returns, and it, for example, it specifies the time period, that 30 days after your, remember this matter was debated extensively, when is the year end? It lays out that 30 days after either your anniversary or the registration of your company, you have to then submit your annual returns. And again, in line with that, you have to specify, obviously, if you buy, if it lays down, if you're a listed company, for example, you have to have an audited statement, or you have to have an independent review statement, and those documents must be submitted. So the, as I said, the regulation on annual returns sets out the time period and what must be submitted as part of your annual returns to the company's office. Then we also have, as you know, the new part of the Act, the new Act dealt extensively with the issue of business rescue, where we, as you know, the provisions of our old company legislation didn't allow for companies who are in trouble but not yet dead. You can hopefully try to hospitalize them for a while. So this regulation deals with the regulations for business rescue practitioners and what criteria they must meet. So it sets that out. It sets out the let's say their qualifications, when you can be a business rescue practitioner, and so forth. They also, as I indicated, it also lays out the qualifications for you to register as a practitioner. For example, you have to, if you're going to assist larger companies, you must have 10 years experience with regard to turning around businesses, and if for small business it lays out that you can have 5 years experience as a practitioner if you're going to help smaller companies and so on. So as I indicated, that is laid out in the regulation, that detail is laid out in the business rescue part of it. And then the other regulation that's quite extensive is the one, as you remember, we built into the Companies Act the social and ethics that we wanted to also make companies responsible citizens, and that they all had to establish a social and ethics committee, or at least the larger ones had to establish social and ethics committee. So this regulation sets out the time period in which they must set it out, and also that to ensure that it's taken seriously at a high level, it specifies that there must be a minimum of 3 directors of the company that serves on this committee. And then it also lays out what are the issues that this social and ethics committee must deal with. So for example, it must deal with environment issues, health and safety issues, labor and employment, consumer issues, and so on. So as I said, this regulation just gives more detail to the intent of the legislature, which was to ensure that companies have some oversight around social and ethical issues. The other regulation then, as I indicated, deals with par value shares. As you know, in terms of the Act, whilst there will be no new issuing of par value shares, they do allow for you to continue to hold these par value shares. So this regulation just tries to give the detail to how these shares should be regulated. So in general, Madam Chair, these regulations, as I indicated, we have extensively workshopped it with companies and with the especially with the business sectors and the different regulatory authorities. We also run regular educational campaigns and currently still carrying on, but it's really just to take people through the regulations. This is just an indication of some of the work done, parties consulted with regard to these regulations. So as I indicated, the regulations have been out now for a few months, and it is currently being investigated, and we're still obviously dealing with lots of queries and explanation and educational workshops around these regulations. Then, Madam Chair, if I can just quickly take you through the consumer. Okay. Madam Chair, at this point, I'll just hand you to deal with the with the Consumer Act. I'll just hand you over to the team to.
Thank you, DG, Madam Chair and Honourable Members. As the DG has indicated, we consulted...
also to put your name in, you know, because when they...
Thank you. The Director, Consumer and Competition Law and Policy.
And that's Mr. Potwana.
Lulama and Mr. Potwana, yes.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I indicated, we consulted extensively on the regulations following the spirit of the Act and to give effect, as the DG has already indicated, to the provisions of the Act. We had bilaterals, we had to wider stakeholder consultations, we went to all the provinces and so on. Our main intention was to try and harmonize and give effect to the provisions of the Act. This just gives the background to the signing of the Act. As the DG has also indicated, the general effective of the Act was the 1st of April this year. So the regulations were also issued on that particular day of the 1st of April after extensive consultation. In fact, when we were last before this committee last year, we had issued the public, we had issued the regulations for public comment. I think that was on the 29th of November, and they remained in the public domain for the next 2 months. I think I've gone through that. I'll start at the threshold determination. In terms of the Consumer Protection Act, the Minister has to prescribe a threshold for juristic persons to be protected under the Act. We initially proposed a threshold of 3 million, looking at other DTI policies, such as the National Small Business Amendment Act. After further consultations with stakeholders, we then reached a decision that this threshold should in fact be 2 million rands. That is just to allow for, because the Act does in fact allow for the incremental implementation currently final regulations were issued at 2 million rand. Because we recognize also that for the Commission, and when we consulted with the National Consumer Commission and the National Consumer Tribunal, we realized that at the earliest stages of these institutions, it is important that it's actually consumers and not juristic persons who will be using the Act, and they also raise capacity issues. But also because the Act does allow for the Minister to increase this threshold, we thought that as these institutions grow in capacity in terms of experience and so on, then the threshold can be increased to protect more businesses. The intention of the Act is primarily to protect the vulnerable citizens of this country. So we thought, you know, the less of companies come forward and use the Act, the more capacity will be used to protect vulnerable citizens. Regulation 2 is about franchise agreements. As honorable members would know, that this industry was largely unregulated previously. Section 7 provided the window for us to start to regulate the franchise industry. We worked very closely with associations such as the Franchise Association of South Africa, who provided guidelines. The regulations that we prescribe, or that the Minister has prescribed, largely focus on issues of transparency, accountability, and just an opportunity for prospective franchisees to know beforehand what is in store for them as they enter into these agreements. The Act itself provides for 10 days cancellation period. That was just directly taken from the Act itself. But most importantly, in our regulations, we provide for the disclosure document, which provides the requirements for example, audited financial statement, you know, so that the prospective franchisee has got, you know, to a certain degree, a level of certainty and comfort as to what is he is buying or it is buying into. The requirements of plain language are also part of the act. We also say that just for greater clarity, the franchise agreement must contain the exact contents of Section 2, that is the right to counsel. I've also explained the issue of, you know, the prescribed minimum information, and that any provision of a franchise agreement that is in conflict with the regulations is void to the extent of such a conflict. I've also explained the issue of a disclosure document that must be provided to a prospective franchisee. Apparently, these are the best practices in the industry so that the prospective franchisee is able to know beforehand and what he's getting himself into. And that there should be statements from accounting officers confirming the contents of the financial statements to be correct. The details of support system, as you know that the franchise system is based largely on the support that the franchisor can provide, the business systems and so on. The additional disclosures, if there are intermediaries involved, then they must be disclosed, the addresses and so on. We know that in the past there have been fly-by-nights where, without mentioning names, where people have paid up front lots of monies only to find that the franchisor does not actually exist. So we are saying that this must be the name of the, if there's an intermediary, the name of the intermediary, the addresses and so on, the contact details. But so far, ladies and gentlemen, we've provided, honorable members, extensively on the franchise agreements. This is just a summary that is of what is contained in the regulations. Section 11 of the primary legislation, the Consumer Protection Act, provides for the privacy, protects the privacy of, taken obviously from also from the Constitution, as the DG has said, the overarching piece of legislation that we have in the country. Unwanted direct marketing. These are instances whereby consumers are consulted at times or when they do not want to be contacted or for products that do not want to be contacted. Some people are reminded that you don't have a funeral policy for your mother, so take it. Well, if you have it, then we are saying that, and you prefer not to be contacted for that particular purpose, there should be a mechanism by which you can say, stop contacting me for this particular service or product, but you may continue, for example, to contact me for other products. We also provide regulation for what is known as junk mail. We prescribe a sign that says, no junk mail or no adverts that can be placed, just like the same sign that says no dogs or you know, or beware dog, or something like that. We have a hand. We have a hand that drops a letter like that, and it's got that line that crosses. That's the one that we prescribe. But I think we also say in the regulation anything similar to that can also be used to say don't drop this in my premises. But the other issue there was definition of a junk mail, but I think we've done fairly well in trying to define what is junk mail. Basically adverts that are not wanted by the owner of the premises. But more so on the issue of the unwanted direct marketing, the Act, the Primary Act also talks about a registry. A registry that will be operated by the National Consumer Commission or an agency or a company appointed by the National Consumer Commission. Largely here, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, what we tried, our primary objective was to protect the security of the information. Once you submit your information to this registry and then you say to the registry or to the administrator of the registry that I do not want to be contacted, you have to provide details. So the information that you submit there should not later be sold to other companies so that they continue to direct you. So we provided a number of regulations around security of information. But most importantly also, or equally importantly, was the issue of accessibility. Consumers should be able to access this register, same as the retailers should be able to access this register without hiccups. This regulation does not become immediately available, applicable, because in terms of the Act, the Minister must satisfy himself that the register will perform what is intended to do. In other words, the security issues, the accessibility issues, after an audit report. Those are the provisions of the Act. So we provide in the regulations how it's going to be administered, if by the Commission, alternatively, even if it's administered by an independent body. So just as to ensure those issues of security and access. Regulation 5 talks about fixed term agreements. We had come previously before this committee and we considered many methods of calculation as to what would be the cancellation penalty that should be applicable. This particular provision is all about consumers' right to cancel a fixed term agreement, because we've seen in the past that consumers would be locked in into contracts that they do not longer want to participate in. Take a gym contract, a cell phone, and many other contracts. So in the Principal Act, the legislature saw it fit to provide consumers with an opportunity, or with a right rather, to cancel on a 20-day notice period. The issue that has arisen very often is the calculation or the method of calculation of that cancellation penalty. Last time we appeared here in our proposed regulations, we had 10%, proposed 10%. The comments that we received from industries was that 10% was not going to be good for all industries. And after carefully considering those comments, in the final draft, we provide a list of factors that can be taken into account in trying to come up with what is a reasonable penalty. We also provide in the regulations that as time goes by, the Commission, working with the Department or the Minister, will identify certain industries and through industry codes that we'll talk about later, prescribe as to what is a reasonable a percentage cancellation penalty for a particular industry, rather than to have a blanket 10% for all industries, whereby it might actually prejudice consumers in certain types of contracts. Some of the factors that we say should be taken into consideration by a retailer or by a supplier is the value of the transaction. Is the value of the goods which remain in possession of the consumer after cancellation, is the value of the goods that are returned to the supplier, duration of the agreement itself, and any losses suffered. These are just some of the factors that we say must be taken into consideration in assessing what could be termed as a reasonable cancellation penalty. Regulation 6, Madam Chair, speaks about product labeling. This comes directly from the Merchandise Marks Act, which is repealed by the Consumer Protection Act. It basically says that we need to know the country of origin of particular goods, the fiber content, and the care instructions. And largely, this is to curb or the advent of counterfeit goods and so on, just to protect the integrity of our products within the country. Product labeling, Regulation 7 on genetically modified organisms. The honorable members will remember that there was a lot of contention about this when the Act was drafted and even when during the drafting of the regulations. But as to what would be the level without necessarily... The percentages that we prescribe here, ladies and gentlemen, are all about the level of tolerance that a country, when we prescribe, in fact, internationally, The percentages that are prescribed is about the level of tolerance that a country is prepared, looking at its particular circumstances, to tolerate the content of genetically modified goods in products, in food basically, and even animal food and so on. So we have to make a lot of considerations around this issue. We also complied with our international obligations in terms of WTO. We wrote to them, and those regulations become effective 6 months from the 1st of April in accordance with our agreements in terms of WTO. So in these regulations, we provide for a 5% threshold because we have to consider the availability of laboratory tests. We have to consider unintended barriers to trade. We have to consider a whole number of other things around this issue. And we say mandatory labeling for any content or ingredients if the GMO content is above 5%. You must label. But if it's below 5%, you are not compelled to label, but you may not claim that the goods does not contain genetically modified goods or GMO. The only time you can claim that or you can label a good as not containing GMO is if it's below 1%. We cannot go beyond 1% or 0.9 because we have to allow for what is called the accidental or adventitious presence of GMOs. That is how we have regulated this matter, hoping that many parties would actually be satisfied, trying to balance the interests of stakeholders. Reconditioned of grey goods, honourable members, this is just all about, that consumers should be made aware. If a retailer is selling the reconditioned goods, they must be made aware. Grey goods, similarly, grey goods are those goods that are brought into the country without warranties, and therefore, if it's broken down, you can no longer take it back to Panasonic South Africa for Panasonic South Africa to honour the warranties because it's bought without warranties. So all we are saying is that here is that consumers must be made aware that the goods are second-hand or the goods come without warranties. Intermediaries, Madam Chair and honourable members, as you know, there would be all kind of intermediaries. So we provided a broad regulation here that's going to cover intermediaries across the spectrum. Of course, excluded from here by the Act are intermediaries that are already regulated in terms of a piece of legislation. In this regard, you will take the financial intermediaries. You will take, for example, people like estate agents. They are not intermediaries that are regulated under this regulation. But generally, we provide that, intermediaries, consumers must be able to identify them, to know them, and so on, so that they can have recourse. And if the intermediaries are acting on behalf of a particular company or representing a certain entity, they must provide their details so that the consumer can be able to identify issues of commission. If there is a commission payable, the consumers must know upfront what an intermediary would be entitled to and so on. Promotional competitions. In these regulations, the minister is given the authority to prescribe a threshold to which the Act and the regulations would apply. We, after consulting, decided that, for all promotional competitions, the Act must apply. So we had a threshold of 1 rand. The 150 rand is a figure that you see on the screen. It's a figure that we say that when entering a promotional competition, a consumer should not be made to pay more than 150 cents for entering even and confirming. This is after extensive consultations. We are satisfied that the 150 is futuristic proof because one of the things that here that we have to deal with is the issue of people promoting their goods but actually making consumers to pay more for the competition, such as you having one car, 350,000, but you're making the entrance fee to be 10 rand. And the promoter actually makes millions, whereas consumers, are only entitled to one car. So we came up with a figure of 150. We think it's a fair figure. When you make an entry, you pay 150. And here we're talking basically electronically transmitting an entry so that you don't get charged 750. There are other forms of entertainment, 750 and so on, will go on, but here we're talking specifically about promotional competitions whereby an entity promotes itself or promotes its goods. One of the issues that we've regulated under promotional competitions is whereby consumers are forced to have their images used for promotional competitions. This also comes directly from the Act. We just added by saying that a consumer must not be forced or compelled to have his image used without her or his consent. We're basically saying that if promoters want to promote their goods, they must consider using models rather than consumers who may not want to have their images splashed over the newspapers right around the country. One of the things that we provide for under promotional competitions is the issue of retaining records. We are saying these records must be kept for 3 years because we have seen in the past that there's a competition that's going on, but we never get to really know who actually won the competition, and then consumers don't really have the right of recourse when they need to, because those records are no longer there. Alternative work schemes, Madam Chair, is about with those work from home, walk my dogs, or do my washing, or that kind of thing, and you can become a millionaire. We are not stopping these kind of alternative work schemes, but we are saying when you advertise them, when you say make millions, you know, staying at home and make millions, it must come with this warning that this is not a guarantee that you'll actually make the millions, so that people know. And people will know this notice, this warning itself, is going to take up a lot of space in your newspaper. So, yeah, you'll be paying for that. So you'll think twice before you actually advertise, you know, I'll walk your dogs and you will earn millions. There are schemes, as you would know. In the past, as the TTI, we experienced a lot of scams, actually, around transport contracts. People, especially pensioners, withdrawing all their pensions to buy trucks only to find that they lose all the money. And here we are providing that, you know, when it comes to transport contracts, again, you cannot guarantee, and also you cannot enter into that kind of arrangement. And we provide that before a consumer actually enters into that kind of arrangement for a transport contract, there shall not be a provision that the consumer will actually forfeit all the money if the consumer cannot perhaps raise security for the rest of the amount owing from a bank. Because this is what used to happen. You would find that a person puts up 100,000 rand to the intermediary. The intermediary promises to get a contract from Sasol worth millions of rands. And the intermediary comes back to the consumer to say that, you see, as long as you still have not secured that 20 million rand loan from ABSA, you are not going to get that contract. And the 100,000 that you have paid, you forfeit to me as an intermediary. That is what we are basically regulating here. And we've seen that happening a lot of times. We've seen the number of complaints around transport contracts. So we're saying intermediaries arranging transport contracts shall not be entitled to that kind of money until such time as the contract has been finalized and the consumer has actually secured the necessary funding. And then we can start talking about the commission. Property syndication schemes, again, we are not closing this down, but we are saying, because the witness here was around the area of valuations, whereby there was fraudulent or crooked valuators who would say this property is worth this much, so we are also providing here for independent valuators so that we come to the true value of the property, so that investors, consumer investors who invest in this kind of schemes are able to determine beforehand what a building is actually worth. We recognize this is a lawful commercial transaction if it's practiced lawfully, but the crooks use it to their advantage whereby they misrepresent the figures in the valuation, or they bribe valuators. So we're talking here about municipal valuations, and you know exactly why municipal valuation will be true, like most most of the time. Feasibility studies, again, are another area where there are scams. We are not closing down on feasibility studies. We realize that they are a very important tool for prospective businesses or even government departments to enter into certain sorts of contracts. But what we are clamping down on are the guarantees whereby a feasibility study guarantees someone and therefore unlawfully induces someone to enter into a contract because we are guaranteed 20 million and then it doesn't happen. So we're saying the guarantee part should fall away. Calculation of interest, these are basically, honorable members, the pyramid schemes. We have used at the DTI this particular formula to say that when you use this formula, you cannot promise anybody returns above a certain rate, because we're using the repo rate, and this is a tried and tested formula that has been used previously, in fact, it's adopted to our previous legislation to say you can't promise people money or returns or profits beyond this. If the prevailing repo rate, and we use this formula, is so much, you can't promise them high above that. Options. Madam Chair, this is an area that has been largely unregulated. We have had several ministers commenting about this. The auctioneering industry itself came to us and said, please regulate us, because in your act, there is room for us to be regulated under the Consumer Protection Act. And we come with a number of regulations here, starting from the advertising, how an auction should be advertised, coming to the actual conduct of the auction, coming also to the bidding process, you know, auctions without a reserve, auctions with a reserve. There was the issue also of if you bid, let's say, property for 1 million rand, there was this automatic forfeiture of 10%, which would be 100,000 rand if the building was, so much. So those are the things that we regulate. We are saying that the consumer should only be liable for the cost of advertising the auction or whichever is the lesser, instead of the automatic 10%. And we provide extensively, and we had bilaterals. We attended workshops one-on-one with the auctioneering industry. We think they are largely very happy. I think there's over 100 regulations in relation to auction advertising standards and so on. The other issue is the lay-bys. We had previously come before this committee with 10%, but we went back after consultations because we did not just consult with business, we also consulted with consumer forums, national consumer unions, and so on. And we were hard-pressed to justify the 10% that the industries are currently using. What's the 10%? Okay, storage costs. But in South Africa, really, storage costs, yes, you do pay, but I don't think we would have come to such an extent that one can actually, you know, compute them and work them into lay-bys. In fact, the Act basically says that if you have lay-by something and the retailer can no longer produce that or provide you with that thing, the retailer must pay you back the full amount plus interest. But in this case, if the retailer can provide but you decide to cancel, because we also thought these are vulnerable people, people who have lost jobs, and they now want to retract or renege from a contract. So why should they be made to pay 10%, and what is the justification for 10%? If it's some of my colleagues say it shouldn't be anything, actually. But we thought that perhaps we should make provision, a small window for administrative costs, a little bit of storage costs, although it cannot be computed. But we could no longer sustain 10%, and hence we are saying that a consumer must not be charged more than 1% of the total cost of goods. Accreditation of consumer protection groups. These groups are already in existence. But in order to bring about integrity and credibility of these institutions, we are providing, you know, a whole set of guidelines as to who may apply as a consumer protection group. This group will not necessarily get funding, direct funding from the department, but for educational advocacy, that kind of thing, these groups will actually get protection. And they have a legal standing to institute proceedings, take complaints on behalf of consumers. Official languages. Madam Chair, also here, we realize the need to, you know, have every consumer, to give every consumer the right to complain in the language of his or her own choice, official languages and so on. But at the initial stages of the Tribunal of the National Consumer Commission, we thought that we should prescribe, as the Act provides, at least for two official languages. Maybe later on when the Commission grows, because we thought it's going to create operational nightmares if at the beginning we say the Commission's documents, official documents, must be in all 11 official languages. It's something that the Department vigorously wants to pursue, the issue of, you know, all the languages being recognized. But at its infancy, we thought that English and Zulu, which is what the Act is in right now, should be the initial languages that are used in the official documents. Of course, complaints can be lodged in any language. Unfair contract terms. Some may remember, Madam Chair, Professor Chaki Naude. This is a very academic subject, but these are contract terms that we are saying should be presumed to be unfair. So when you see this contract term in a contract, it's presumed to be unfair. So the onus already shifts on the supplier or the relator to prove that this particular contract term is in fact fair under particular circumstances. We have got a list of them. They are sometimes called the grey list as opposed to the black list or the white list. In other words, it's a grey list in the sense that unless proved to be black or white, it remains grey. And then it's the onus would be on the supplier to prove that, okay, this is actually not a bad contract term in this particular type of contract. It's an international move around consumer protection to say certain terms. For example, a term when you say excluding the liability of the supplier, we have seen such terms. Supplier shall not be liable for any injuries or death resulting from the consumer participating in this program. We are saying such terms should be presumed to be unfair. The minister, those are the regulations, ladies and gentlemen. The minister has also issued certain notices, about three of them. Authorization. The Act provides that the minister may provide a threshold for authorization, for pre-authorization of repair or maintenance. In other words, when you take your article for repairs, you should be able to get a free quotation. So here we also thought very hard, and we came to a decision that, you know what, this Act is not necessarily designed for the BMW X5 driver who doesn't care if the repair is 5,000. This Act is designed for the old lady who's sitting somewhere in the corner there of Eastern Pua corner of Eastern Cape and so on, who would be concerned if he took an iron for repairs and he's going to be charged 50 rand. So we said, for all repairs, a consumer must be provided with a free quotation and give consent before the repair is there. Otherwise, she would stand to lose the article. Sales records, the Act provides that the minister may prescribe the type or the category of persons or transactions whereby a sales record will not be required. Here you may think of your street vendor or your hawker on the street selling loose cigarettes, you know, and so on. Or a shebeen in the township whereby, you know, you buy one beer, you get a receipt, you buy another beer, you get another, or, you know, or you buy one apple and so on. So we have to come here with a category, so we define the hawker. We came up with our definition of a hawker, that a hawker, we must not, because we also thought of spaza shops, and we consulted with SARS, and spaza shops would be required to comply with the SARS, you know, paying taxes and so on. So we couldn't just accept spaza shops, and we thought, if you buy a can of fish, you need to prove where you bought it. So spaza shops may have to come up with some form of receipt. But we thought we'd come up with a definition of hawker just to exclude certain persons from having to provide. I don't think the legislature does not legislate absurdly or with absurdity. Yeah, so we excluded this person. Prohibit the time for conducting consumers, well, lots of debate, but ultimately we have to take into consideration the government's imperatives to create jobs and so on. So if we set 6 o'clock, we have to balance that with the right of people to work until 8 o'clock. And we conducted our own surveys and we felt comfortable that people can be conducted right up till 8 o'clock in the evening and again from 8 o'clock of the following day. But they can't be conducted on Sundays, on public holidays, at home for purposes of direct marketing. So you shouldn't be called at this particular time. You shouldn't be receiving SMSs and so on electronically during these hours. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, consumer. As I indicated, those are the sets of regulations that we've issued, and the most of them have come into effect, and others will come into effect over a period. The only final issue which the Minister has dealt with, as you can see, is the issue of exemptions and deferments under these Act. And as you can see, what we've adopted is a pragmatic approach. Like we have exempted hawkers, we also got an application from, for example, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which wanted the exemption from the return of goods or return of shares issue. As you recall, we got in the Act that if you are regulated by another authority, you can apply for regulation. And as you know, with regard to share trading, there's a difference between the financial transaction and returning or cancelling a gym contract or returning a vacuum cleaner. So, I mean, the Minister was, for example, on the JSE, was satisfied that the Securities and Exchange Commission adequately regulates this matter, even at a higher level than the Consumer Protection Act. So in those instances, we would give we granted the JSE an exemption from that particular provision, as we did for the hawker. As you can see, we have to deal with very different entities, and clearly we have to issue regulations which takes into account our reality. So, Madam Chair, those are the regulations we've issued, and any questions we could we will take.
First of all, thank you very much, DG, and also thank you very much for Botswana over there, really. We had earlier thought, when I discussed this with the whip, that we would separate both presentations, but then after discussion with the DG, it was clear they were much shorter than we expected. However, I do think that in our deliberations, in our questions and comments, we should separate it somewhat, you know, rather than companies and then consumer. May I suggest and just get an idea from yourself, members, shall we start off with companies then and so much time for consumers? Can I get an agreement or what is Honourable for David?
Chairperson, I think that any member can raise the issue on either of the two, but must indicate whether it's companies, so that for the sake of the presenters when they respond back.
Okay, I'm just thinking you can only get one set of overheads on board, but that was part of the issue. But if there's a, you know, the department is comfortable in jigging around, would you be comfortable with that? Okay, now they're fine. So what is proposed then is just if it is the companies, you say companies. If it is consumer, you say consumer. Okay. And we move from that point. But let's take a few bites at the cherry without exhausting life. Maybe 2 points from each one to start. There will be several rounds after tea. It continues, so we shouldn't think it's now going to be chopped. Yes, Honorable Mabasa, other hands, please. Honorable Elberts, Honorable Khadebe. That is three. Yeah, that's not a hand. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Comrade Chair, and thanks for the inputs made. On the companies, I wanted to find out whether the in executing the act, to what degree do we exempt SMMEs, cooperatives, from what the Act seeks to do, you know, as it protects consumers, but I mean other companies. So that's my first question, because I mean if SMMEs and big companies are bundled as one, the SMMEs will suffer. And then my second question is under consumer, I couldn't understand, or let me rather say, I have observed that the tow trucks that tow vehicles immediately after an accident, that much robbery, for lack of a better word, takes place there, because the consumer, being the driver of the vehicle, is vulnerable. Horrible people like my neighbor here are waiting. They want to go past. He's not as kind as he looks, so he wants impatient. He wants to pass, and as they hoot, and then the truck, you know, those people then come at that time, and they immediately connect onto your vehicle so that they want to tow it. Before you know what is happening, it's already been towed, and they say, "Do you want to follow us?" So. But the worst is there's a storage fee. A storage fee over 12 hours, you'll find you may have to pay 5,000. So, and if you don't have it, in 3 days' time, it will have been multiplied by three, and then you may eventually decide you no longer need that car. So, I think that's one part that needs serious regulation. The last one is the club holiday schemes, where you join and they say, no, you'll go on holiday and you earn points, and but then it's also possible that even when you want to quit, you can't quit. They will have written in very small letters that you can't quit. And even if you have very good reasons. So you may end up just paying annual fees, etc., for 10 years without going on holiday once. So I thought those two areas need their attention. Thanks.
Three very good points there. Yes, Honorable Elders.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the Companies Act, I'm not sure if... the Act has changed. The previous Act did not require that you should, or that Cipro would keep a record of shareholders in private companies. If you wanted to find out who shareholders are, owners of the company, you can't necessarily find that information at Cipro before, and whether the new Act actually requires that information to be kept somewhere. on the Consumer Act, on stopping direct marketing, just a practical question, how would one deal with newspapers who have inserts, they have direct marketing, would that be regarded as direct marketing where you have advertising inserts in newspapers? You find a lot of these community newspapers are filled with marketing material, and how would that be dealt with? Secondly, regarding intermediaries, I just want to make certain what the, whether it was an establishment of excluding estate agents from the Act, such I didn't hear that part, or I might have missed it, and then also with regard to lawyers who act as intermediaries, how whether there is an exclusion there, because many lawyers facilitate transactions. They actually are nothing but intermediaries, and just how you deal with that. Thank you very much.
Good points. Thank you. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that we it's so good to hear good information such early in the morning when it's so cold. At least we can see that our country is advancing forward. But there are certain questions I'd like to ask, in particular concerning the consumer regulations. I can see they are so good and so comprehensive, but the issue is, how are these regulations going to reach the consumers themselves? Because I might know them. What about someone who's somewhere in a small town in the Free State of Memel? They're going to get all these rights about the labor that they can only now charge only 1% instead of the 10% which was usually done before. And then number two, it will be the issue of the power between the Consumer Commission and the Ombudsman. Because in certain sectors we have ombudsmen, like in the insurance industry, short-term insurance industry, medical aid schemes, we've got ombudsmen. Who's who in that? Where should the consumers go to? Is it going to better to go to the Consumer Commission or the ombudsman? And then you go to the issue again. Take example, we have here around Cape Town, we have a lot of these things known as factory shops. In the factory shops, you find that there are big boards that once you buy a product here, you cannot return it. You cannot exchange it to get a point. So how is this thing going to affect those shops and consumers who are buying from those shops? Thank you. I'll come back for the second question.
Great. Yes, just before you, Honourable Kamado, Comrade, Honourable Fala, and Honourable Kwabasa, Honourable Kumalo.
Chairperson, the first question is, on a daily basis, through laptops, through cell phones, desktops, in many different ways of communication, there are people that want to get in between you and whoever you deal in business with, either the bank or the bond or whoever you exchange money with for this or that other reason. And these people get involved into these things in order to get your details and divert money to them. I know for a fact this year I have received a number of times phone calls that were saying I'm owing my TV license. And I phoned home to ask my wife what's happening to the TV license. It's there, it is valid, but we owe it. And a whole range of those. In my laptop I receive a lot of emails that are coming from United States of America, others are coming in London and so on, where I have won lots of millions of rent. I must just send the details. How are we going to, how do I as a consumer get protected against those particular kinds of, I wonder where they will fall under, what do you call them, intermediaries? Or they are crooks anyway. They are scams. What protection can these regulations able to help with. Coming back to the presentation, there is this Regulation 5 on the fixed term agreements. You may enter into an agreement at the time you agree for a period of 2 years, 3 years. But in the as time goes, you feel that period is too much. Is there a provision for amendment, protection for the consumer to amend the terms and conditions of that agreement, including the period? Okay. Then the next question would be Regulation 7. It's currently making reference to 5% of genetically modified organisms. This is the new regulation. What is the status quo currently, especially as it referred to meth and other similar genetically modified things that we use. Regulation 8 refers to grey goods. The question I'm asking myself is, are these legal? Are these legal issues? If they are not, why are we seemingly attempting to protect illegal activity? In my view, if they are not legal, we cannot be seen as government to try to give them legal status unless they are beneficial to our society. Okay.
I will come later.
Yeah, Chair, two questions, but the first one has partly been covered by Honorable Silao, which relates to, for instance, these intermediaries. Where it refers to the intermediaries, some of them which are illegal. For instance, you receive an email which says that you have received a refund from SARS. Now, how do you protect both the person who must be paying taxes, consumer in a way, and the institution itself that is being alleged to have refunded you, and you realize that in fact is not true? The second one is on the on slide 18, the reconditioned or grey goods. I think sometime last year there was a media report about meat that has passed its sell by date, and it then is taken back, washed, reconditioned, and so on, and then brought back. Does that protect the consumer against that kind of goods? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kobasa, Honourable Kamalo, Honourable Smala. After that, is it myself, Chair? Oh, thanks. No, Chair, I just want to understand on the Companies Act that the form which pursues the transparency on accounting record, that there is any assistance that is catered for in the event that the accounting record necessary is not requirements is not met, and timelines as well after that assistance has been catered for, the timeline that is put in place for people who are expected to meet the requirement for recording their for accounting record purposes. Thanks.
Much, Honourable Smiler.
Yeah, I will come on the second round again.
Just a point of comment. It would have been very much useful if we did the company's regulations together with the Companies Act at the same time, a little bit more, as we did now. It would have clarified a bit of things then, and not come now, you know, after the process. I think we must just maybe in the future, if we do similar legislation, try to streamline them a little bit better. It makes debates much more easier. On the DG, I want to talk on the consumer side. On the regulations of auctions, we did set there's only a party part here, but I would like to understand maybe or the liquidation of issue, the protection of liquidation when liquidations actually comes into effect, and protecting the consumer. And by meaning the reserve price, people not being exploited, selling a house that's worth R1 million for R100,000, vehicles, etc., etc., and the protection of the consumer after that, if such a thing actually does take place. How, you know, because I'm already on a vulnerable run, and now how do I go about, you know the regulations of that part. The exemption of the hawkers, understanding that no proof should be kept. How does that assist our security departments if a security, and I'm talking about the SAP now, needs to deal with issues of investigation when you are being exempted by that? And I'm going to talk about, because I deal with that on a very daily, weekly, monthly basis, on the fresh product market. Where people would steal fresh products, and those fresh products get sold by hawkers on that. And that is my concern. How does this fit into or assist the security or the assistance of the SAP? If the SAP wants to have proof of sale of that, then just please assist me in that part in assisting our other sister department in doing his or her job. That's my two questions. I will stick to my 2 second round. Will come others. I'm going to be.
We after tea even, you know, but tea could even be delayed. I would like to put my questions forward now, and then if they aren't responded to before I leave, I'm sure I will be informed of this by colleagues. But there are two issues here. The one is in relation to companies. I must say we were very pleased to learn that Treasury had been consulted in every respect. So thank you very much in that regard, because it had come up earlier, as you know, when we had the actual act, a bill in front of us. But when I looked at business rescue, which we all welcome, you know, whole concept and so on, and many of the regulations here, I know that we wanted as many people as possible who had the skills to be able to assist in this direction. But I just have a little concern with, it says the last bullet point here under business rescue on this page, junior practitioner who has no experience. No. Now, I have a problem, you know, if you even had a year or two, I can understand something along the lines of maybe 2 years, between 2 and 5 years, but to have somebody walks out of university, walks out of college, I really don't think they can help you to rescue your business. So, but it says here, who has no experience. I think they're rather dangerous, like firing a gun, you know, without a safety catch on or something. I really have a deep concern about the no experience. You know, not even a day. Your certificate could be barely dry. So that particular one. So I am prepared to look at something myself and maybe the committee on a little bit less, but higher than the no, 2 years or something. The other issue in that regard concerns, and it's probably an insurance issue, but I don't know, it's not really. You know, your car does go in for repair. And for that matter, I suppose any other thing. But in particular, the cars. You've got brand new tyres on, and certainly myself, I was unaware until I was helping someone, that every tyre has a date on it. You see, hardly anyone knows that. And with the make, the date, the lot, the date. So, fortunately, this person had taken extensive photographs when they got their car, bought their car, you know, just very recently, but wanted just something adjusted. So, photographs here, all over the place, and went blown up. I wondered why the friend of mine, who I sought assistance from to assist this constituent, was saying, you know, if you'd only known the dates. I said, oh, I know we've got the date of the sale, this person, you know, etc., and with the date it went in. They said, no, of the tyre. The tyre. Don't you know when the tyre is, the date? I said, I'll check. Well, of course, no one thinks of asking for that. But the photographs revealed, I forget, I think it was like September something, brand new tyre, and this gone into something in November. And the tyres it was replaced with, which this guy complained about, were, one was almost threadbare, and the other was really quite, you know, strange, compared to the fact that these tyres were all supposed to be 3 months old, you know. And it was in that way they could prove. Now, I'm wondering if the consumer law, so it goes in for repairs, you see, but the tyres are replaced. The repair is well done. Nothing wrong with the repair. First class. But the tyres are changed. Three of them. Now, it does this cover that? And how? Thank you very much. DG, I'm just thinking that we should probably look at this point. It's just 5 to 11. I don't know what anyone else's clock is saying. What is it? We have a choice of going on with this and getting the responses thereof before tea break, or going to an early tea if there is tea. Is there tea? And then coming back, getting the responses, and then going for the next take on questions and comments. Honourable Smuller?
Chair, I would like to support your second proposal that we go now for the responses and then go for the second bite after that, so that this is still fresh in our minds, so that we can just...
Well, that was the first approach. Right. Okay, over to the DG.
Thanks. I think I'll just hand over to the colleagues to deal with the questions, and I'll round up. We'll start with the companies.
No, thanks. And good morning. I'm responding to Honorable Mazaso's question on the SMMEs. How are they exempted, like in the Consumer Protection Act? I understand the question as seeking things such as alleviation of regulatory burden, something of that sort, but it is in broad terms. So I cannot exhaustively list all of them. This question has been asked over and over here, but I can think of audit and independent review and the owner managed company where the owner manager prepare a statement and somebody comes and see to it that it is a true reflection that this company is financially viable and the like. So independent review, we debated here, we introduced them here in order to show a distinction between an audit and independent review. And we said not all all companies should prepare financial statements, but not all of them should be audited, because auditing is very vigorous, costing, all those issues. But independent review, which is an international standard, but of a lower standard, but is acceptable worldwide. So therefore, this is the area where we say, can we alleviate this burdensome to our companies? I just singled out this thing because it is that issue, it is still hot. Can I leave the matter there? Yes. So there is this issue of shareholders' details. Can we access them? I have a section here. I will quote it. Can I pass? But I will give you a section. The forms. Is there any assistance? What are the timelines? And then we are saying, by the way, the rationale of this act was to take away the criminalization part of it. In the olden days, if you forget to do a small thing, they will say it shall be an offense. But now we have taken all those issues. There can be some administrative penalties, but we are staying away from punishing people for the sake of forgetting to write a detail of a certain director and the like. Why can't we say, okay, everything accepted, but on such and such a day, bring that other information, then we'll continue processing. So yes, if you go to the commission, which is an old CEPRO, if I may say so, you will find that the alliance and the like, there are people in the front who are assisting people on how to fill in the forms, and then what are the timelines for all processes. These regulations, you can see they are voluminous, but there are people who are assisting them because these are the new issues or concepts. The other issue was just a comment from Honorable Smale to say when we process an act, if possible, let's also process the regulations. I think in principle we're agreeing. But what happened just previously, 2 months ago or so, it was an exception, but I think in principle, I'm also responding as a statement to say, yes, it is doable. But generally, you come with an act and you ask for a mandate from Parliament. Parliament sets the tones and they say, go and prepare the regulations. So generally, they cannot be simultaneously developed. I'm just commenting. The business rescue issue, we concede that there is a problem if somebody does not have an experience. But generally, you find that these people make coming with qualifications, MBAs, multidisciplinary areas, and the like, depending on what this sick person wants. There is always a first day on everything. Coming with experience may be difficult, but experience is not per se the only determining factor. But we concede that just to come and start to do an operation which is supposed to be done by a person of 20-year experience, that would be wrong. But at a point of entry, there are certain areas where a person comes with qualifications and then one day is to be allowed to put the academic qualification into practice. I think that's what we're catering for. Yeah, but we are prone for further advice. Just in passing again, this regulation, there is a section under the Act to say if there is anything that needs to be done, the minister can give Honorable Albert.
In the first instance do a formal handover to the whip, the Honourable Khadebi to chair. Just for the record, but as I've already handed in an official apology, I am the official rep from Parliament on Parmet with the annual general meeting, which is starting at 11 in Mark's building. I really don't have a choice. This was altered to accommodate Parliament's budget yesterday, you know, so please excuse me, I do apologise. But before I leave, Mr. Nyetse Tenzi, I was thinking more along the lines of this person with a not yet dry process to at least assist with in another process beforehand, for at least a year or two before on their own going in. That's really, I think they must get experience. They must. Thank you. But allow the whip to sit down before you continue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Go and represent us well in Parliament, because the benefits are diminishing by day. I think that must take it straight to the Consumer Commission. All right, Chief Director, can you continue with the responses, please?
No, thanks. Thanks. For Honourable Albert, I think this is Section 26 of the Principal Act, read together with the Section 26 on access to company records, and then also the issue of forms and standards for company records. But your question was, as saying the details of the shareholders, if somebody wants them, is it now allowed? My reading of this section is that it is allowed, but there are certain information which people should not demand, which may give rise to privacy and other issues, but at a raw level, Section 26 is in point of the Act.
Chair, may I just follow up with another question for clarification? will the information be with the Commission, or will you still have to go find the information, request the information from the individual company itself, as it is the case today?
Yeah, the Commission will have certain information that can be requested. And then a director's details and the like. Yeah, that's the Commission. But when you go to the issue of going straight to the company, I think, shareholder, we debated this issue during the amendment to say you can follow the issue of the Public Access Information Act. And then we also dealt with the issue of saying the commission should have standards to cut that bureaucracy under the buyer, the Public Access Information Act. That amendment was addressing exactly what you were saying. But we can go offline, I think it is. Yeah. Right together with the Companies Amendment Act, because the issue of access to information was dealt with the Amendment Act.
To clarify, I mean, in terms of the Commission, I mean, there is the details of the company and its directors is available from the company's Commission, but the shareholder register, as you indicated, that is with the company itself.
But what the Act does is allow you access, or it enforces the company must provide you with that information on request, and I think a payment of a certain amount or something for printing costs and so on. But at least what the Act does is it forces the company to disclose and be transparent as well. I think we'll then go to the consumer quickly, and then I'll come back.
Thank you.
All right, can you turn on the mic, please?
Thank you, Chair. I'll go straight to, firstly, the Honorable Mamasa's questions regarding the towing industry. Yes, we have encountered problems there, such that we had to call in these people when we were consulting during the regulations stage. I think there's one of the associations called ATASA, Association of Towing Agents of South Africa, something like that. And we tried to capture what they raised were the problems of unscrupulous, you know, something very akin to ambulance chasing in the legal profession, where there's an accident, you know, finally rushing to that place. So the same that happens here. In fact, you actually even hear stories of agents, towing agents, causing accidents so that, you know, they can remain in business. And to come directly to the question that was raised about storage costs and stuff, the approach that we used is that contained in the regulations on intermediaries. We have about 50 there regulations, and some of these regulations talk to address the issues of amounts, sums, values, charges, remuneration that must be paid by the consumer, which should be disclosed to the consumer before the transaction is entered into. We also provide that the agreements must later on be in writing and so on. So to a large extent, I think the issue of some of the issues that arise in that particular industry, we tried to regulate them or to rectify them through the intermediary regulations. But we also said to them that through the industry codes that the minister will prescribe, we will also look further into other areas that may remain unregulated in that particular industry. Because the Consumer Protection Act, honorable members, is an overarching piece of legislation, but we also need to look at sector-specific legislation where it can be necessary. Like I indicated earlier on, the intermediary regulations are just to cover any intermediary. We have to imagine any intermediary possible who can be in existence that is not regulated. On the issue of holiday schemes, again, I must refer to sector-specific legislation here. There is certain sector-specific legislation, at least two pieces of legislation, the share block schemes and the property controlled share property act. I might just be mixing the words. Those are sector-specific legislation. Yes, it is legislation that is administered by the DTI, and we have had some complaints. But the Consumer Protection Act also says clearly that it is not here to work, does not specifically regulate. The Consumer Protection Act does not sort of do away or washes away the common laws and the sanctity of the respect to the sanctity of a contract. But if it's not a contract, if this holiday scheme is not a contract in terms of those two pieces of legislation, it is in fact a fixed-term contract. It can still be cancelled under the Consumer Protection Act. But if it's a share block that has been bought in terms of those pieces of legislation, a resolution should be found in terms of those two pieces of legislation, which basically means one of the resolutions, I don't think is mandatory, is for the scheme itself to buy back. But what about where you get a situation whereby you get a majority of people wanting to sell their shares in a scheme and the scheme is unable to buy it back? What do you do in such circumstances? Like I indicated, it becomes a very specific and unique legal issue that has been to be dealt fact by fact and the circumstances of each scheme. But if it's not a scheme, you can cancel it under Section 14. It's just a fixed-term contract of the Consumer Protection Act. Of course, like I said, you still have to respect the sanctity of a contract or the law of contract. The Honorable Advocate Albert newspaper adverts and junk mail, we actually thought about that matter. Hence, we say in the regulations that if the advert is not primary, because we also thought about municipal accounts, which are sent to you at the back, you find an advert for mattresses and stuff. We're saying that if the correspondence or the communication is not primarily for purposes of advertising a particular product, then it is not junk mail. And that, again, using common law, if you buy a newspaper and you know that the Sunday Times, for example, is that, you know, in a way you have tacitly agreed to receive that junk mail. Intermediaries are, at the Honorable Albert explained that, I mean, raised the issue of exclusions. All I was saying is that in terms of the definitions, and we have got about 25 slides here we just brought for this committee of the Act itself. We haven't incorporated the regulations yet. The Act says that in the definition of an intermediary, it excludes, the definition of an intermediary excludes an intermediary that is regulated in terms of other legislation. Hence, I was saying estate agents and probably attorneys, because there's the Attorneys Act, they will be excluded. So we're regulating other intermediaries that are not regulated, and the five intermediaries and so on will be excluded. The Honorable Khadere, how are the regulations going to reach consumers? A very important question. The National Consumer Commission has got a statutory mandate, and we as Policy and Legislation Division of the DTI, as custodians of these pieces of legislation, we also do run workshops. We invited, you know, to workshops, and we run our own workshops, and we collaborate with other institutions in running workshops. So we do try, but the statutory mandate is imposed on the NCC, and it's got a dedicated, I know that it's got a dedicated division that focuses on advocacy and education, and it should actually do that. We're hoping also the consumer protection groups, but not hoping, it's a statutory mandate also for them, because they are very closest to the far corners of this country, the rural corners, that they will be able to impart, and through the NCC giving them the necessary material, they will be able to impart the knowledge to consumers. The relationship between the NCC and the Ombudsman, what comes to mind is Section 69 of the Act, that it lays out how a complaint is going to be laid and how is the relationship before the NCC. We are encouraging that the DTI, the NCC, that the ombuds that exist should continue to do their work. The ombuds that will be accredited in terms of the Act will have a relationship with the NCC, because the NCC will recommend their accreditation, and they will report to the NCC. We have, through the regulations, provided accountability or reporting mechanisms to the NCC, so that to ensure the credibility and integrity of these schemes. So Section 69 will tell you that first you lodge a complaint with the, you know, in fact we'd rather prefer that complaints were dealt with at the shop floor first, and then they go to the ombudsperson. And then the ombudsperson, if the matter is not resolved, then the matter is referred to the NCC. Vice versa. The NCC can also refer a matter to a statutory, non-accredited or accredited ombudsperson. The return of goods from factory shops on the issue of grey goods, I think. It is a right in terms of this Act to return goods that are defective for repairs. If the goods are not properly repaired, then the consumer may also demand a refund. The Act, the minimum requirement that the Act requires is disclosure. If it's a second-hand good, like a reconditioned good, or it's a factory good, so there would be factory faults. The common law would then apply that if it's disclosed to the consumer beforehand, because we don't want to close that market, then the consumer consent, the consumer cannot go back and complain that, you know, this thing is torn, because it's because there's this thing maybe I should turn about the Footstool Agreement. You buy it as it is. There's a perception that this act closes 100%, never to be heard of, the Footstool Agreement. But that's not entirely true. If there is disclosure, you can still buy goods footstools, which means the same situation as with factory goods, but there must be disclosure of the defects that are there, so that at least the consumer knows. So you can negotiate better because you know what defects this shoe has. The Honorable says, allow protection against scams. I'm trying to call the specific question because I didn't quite capture it, but or let me revert to that, Honorable Member.
All right, can Honorable Slough repeat that question? But I think it's dealing with phishing, which comes from the internet. Let's say when you open the internet, your internet, you find that, you get something like you have won lottery in England, but the issue, why should you be so greedy that you know you didn't play lottery? How can you win when you didn't do that? But I think around that line, but you can put it better, Mr.
Yeah, all right. Thank you. I think Honorable Chair has reminded me. Unless you want to add.
There are a number of versions. It's not a one-way thing. What the Chair says is one of the things. But what happens is that they come in different ways. They can come and say to you, say, you are owing me railway furniture. You are paying your monthly installment. They can send you a letter that you are in arrears and we are planning to repossess the goods within 7 days unless you pay so much into the following account. Then they give you details of your account. And they say, for inquiry, phone number so and so and talk to so and so. And when you phone that number, they want details of your bankings and so on and so forth. Then if once you give those details, then your money in the bank is gone. You know, they have various ways of doing it, including the fact that they can tell you that you have won when you did not play, you know.
All right. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Section 42, we've got about, like I said, you brought a couple of these. Section 42 of the Act tries to capture all sorts of those schemes. I can just read from the first sentence. A person must not initiate, sponsor, promote, or knowingly participate in the distribution of any communication that offers to supply in or enter into an agreement to supply any goods or services, and then it goes on. And then the elements there are those of fraud. Like I said, common law still applies, but it's reinforced here to say there must be an element of falsely misrepresenting certain issues or the information to a consumer, like you have one and so on. And from Section 42, that's where we have also built into that formula I talked about earlier about pyramid scheme. You can't say somebody's going to earn more than this, the transport schemes and so on. But Section 42 in itself of the main act is a very long section, and it tries to capture all those knowingly or intentionally with intention to defraud a particular person, and we try to capture all those kinds of schemes in Section 42. I just wanted not to go through all of it, but I'm satisfied. I'm confident that Section 42 would cover many of those instances. To receive an SMS, send us 10,000 rand so that you can claim your prize, or we are the only heir, we discovered you are the heir to the kingdom of Ghana somewhere, and therefore you must send so much money so that you can facilitate the transfer of the rest of your, you know, of your loot or whatever, inheritance. That's what we try to capture. Vodacom, I've seen those myself. They come through the cell phone sometimes. And then that's what Section 42 tries to capture. Regulation 5, amending the period of fixed term agreement. I think this one is a very technical issue. I would not claim to provide a full answer. If you've got a right to cancel, in a way, it also implies that you'd have a right to amend that agreement to a shorter period, because what you're saying basically is, I'm cancelling for this particular period, but yes, we haven't specifically provided for amending. The Act provides for cancelling, hence in the regulations, I would say we didn't have the scope to just say, okay, to supplement the primary legislation, because that would be ultra-virus or outside the scope of the law. But yeah, within Section 14, the right to cancellation, in a fitting circumstance, can be used to amend rather than to cancel a certain agreement. So you cancel it for 24 months, but you say, I want to remain for 12 months. But also, that also depends on the cooperation of the supplier. But the Act and the regulation do not specifically use the word amend. Maybe it's something that, you know, as complaints come in, perhaps that we would like to look at. The status quo regarding the genetically modified organisms is that the Department of Health has got its own regulations. Our Consumer Protection Act regulations are aimed at disclosure, the information, so that the consumer knows. The regulations under the Department of Health are more aimed at allergies. If it's above this, it creates allergies and so on. It's more, not just on knowledge, but on health properties of that particular medicine that contains genetically modified goods. The Department of Agriculture also regulates to a certain extent, because there's a council that is called the Genetically Modified Goods Council, and they try to approve, they approve which goods can be commercialized in South Africa, which goods that contain GMOs can be used on a commercial scale. So far it's maize, soybean, and cotton, I think. So we followed that example, but from our side we had to regulate for purposes just of consumer information. From our side we're saying it's not, unlike the Department of Health, we're not measuring whether it's healthy or not and so on. We are just saying the consumer must know. So there has been regulation to a certain extent by those two departments. Science and Technology has taken also a very keen interest on this particular issue. Because around this issue, when you close it down, there are issues of employment and so on. But that's not for me to discuss. So there has been a level of regulation. The DTI comes in at this level. Yes, grey goods are legal. There have been competition, pro and anti-competition issues around grey goods. When you introduce a grey good into the country at a lower price, you're putting pressure on your competitors who supply the same goods to produce that good at a lower price. You know, it could be an academic debate whether they should be promoted to a certain extent. In fact, it has been an academic debate in my knowledge. But yes, grey goods are legal. As long as you bring them into the country, if they are from outside, and you pay your taxes and customs and so on, you can sell them. The only issue is that you don't have the warranties. And there are benefits to the consumer. One, like I said, in respect of competitive products. There are benefits to consumer in terms of lower prices, innovation, and so on. So it's acceptable worldwide. But it can be looked at country by country. My colleague would like to add on grey goods.
So on the issue of grey goods, it's true that there are benefits, a lot of them.
Can they shift the turn of the mic?
Yes, grey goods are very good for a country, in particular in price war, if I may say so. But sometimes we have been lobbied from the intellectual property point of view to say we should say these are counterfeit goods. And then the committee, the council which existed before this act came into being, did a study and issued a notice to say grey goods are legal, and then people are encouraged to buy them, but there should be disclosure that if a warranty is no longer there, tell the consumer to know. So we have a notice which is still in force. They are legal and they are not counterfeit goods, but they are, they should be in compliance with the Act, what my colleague has been saying. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Babaza, the refund from, I'm not sure if that was a competition, company or consumer issue. But I answer firstly the one about the sell-by date. Yes, there was a huge issue around chicken, the weight of the chicken and so on, the reconditioning of the chicken by some companies in that particular industry. Section 25 talks about grey goods. We have got the Act itself is also peppered with provisions around misleading marketing or unconscionable conduct. So yes, such companies can be caught. Other under Section 25 for not disclosing that those are reconditioned chickens, or other provisions of the Act that talk to misleading representations, unconscionable conduct, and so on. Because if you look at the meaning of unconscionable, it sort of catches all those crooked behaviors by retailers. So yes, that would be regulated under the Act itself. what can you call it? Thank you, Chair. On the, I propose that I come later to the issue of the refund of sales. Like I indicated, Chair, I'm not sure if there's a company or, but I think it was a company issue.
No, Chair, I was asking if there is protection against those intermediaries who appoint themselves to say that you are refunded by SARS, and in fact you trace that to SARS and it is not true, and SARS does not even know those people.
I think sometimes it can be difficult to regulate against greed, because really, if you know you didn't play Lotto, how do you expect to win Lotto? If you didn't file a return, what do you expect? Why do you expect something? But let them answer.
I couldn't agree more with you, Chair. Yes, it would be very difficult. But I think also common law here would apply, because we still have our criminal law, and some of these things will still be caught up in other pieces of legislation. And maybe there are SARS regulations that prevent, you know, those kind of charlatans. People say that they are what they are not, and they want to scam. I think Honorable Travis, quite honestly, it's one of the issues that have to be looked at case-by-case basis. What are the facts? What did the person actually represent? What did he say he is to you? And you are integral. What was he trying to do? Was he trying to scam that you have got a refund from SARS so that you could divert that payment, you know, using your details, which would be a crime of fraud or maybe other related crimes. So under the Act, I would say it's not specifically regulated unless on a case-by-case basis, perhaps Section 42, the one that regulates fraud and related scams, may, because that one also is a huge one, it's a catch-all. It says anyone who does anything that misrepresents or miscommunicates to another person with an intention to defraud that or to prejudice that person shall be guilty of an offense in terms of this Act. So one has to look closely at the facts of that particular case and the provisions of Section 42. If this Act cannot assist, I'm sure the criminal law will assist. The Honorable Smollett, on liquidation and production of a reserved price. I was actually trying to look at that in the regulations, because we consulted widely and extensively on the issue of the reserved price. if it's a matter, because like I said, the auction regulations are about 120 of them, and I don't remember the specific provision, which I think is a very important one, that says a consumer should have a say in determining the reserved price. Because like you say, if the property is worth 1 million and it's sold for 100,000 and the consumer still owes 500,000, then the consumer is prejudiced because it remains owing the bank. But we did look at it from that perspective. I'm not sure if it went into the regulations right now. And also we had to look at it from the perspective that the bank is still the legal owner of the property. And the bank has got an interest whether in fact currently the bank will recover the 100,000. And he would have obtained a judgment prior to the litigation processes, which would have entitled them to execution. And then if there's not sufficient property realized at execution, then it goes further to the liquidation. So the bank would be an interested party. I think the conflict would arise as to whether to take forward the interests of the bank in recovering the 100,000 immediately, or to take into consideration the interests of the consumer who will remain owing the bank.
All right. Thank you, Chair, because it works both ways. I might owe the bank 100,000. My property is worth 1 million. Therefore, the property gets sold for 200,000. The bank has got its interest. I'm fine. I've got my money back, the bank, so the loaner. And the bank initiated the liquidation sale or which either way. And then, because you do find that in this specific spectrum, you get the financial institutions and the sheriffs of the courts, they conclude together in when dealing with these products and stuff. And I was hoping that one would say that, like you were talking to a municipal value, to let's say 25% or 30% of evaluation, of evaluation norm, or whatever the game, if it comes to fixed property, because fixed property is quite easy to evaluate. It's not like a car that depreciates. So when you regulate that, I honestly think that we need to protect the consumer, and if we cannot do that, then we've got to put guidelines for that consumer to say, okay, I can go to somewhere in your department in order to assist, or they've got to be a time like a 10-day trial period in order to lodge a complaint with you at the department within a two-week time period for you then to assess if the sale was fair or not fair, and then just to bring that sort of a constituency period in, and you can broaden the spectrum. But look, we haven't got all those details there, but I as you said, I would try to go and read some more on that, but if it's not there, we'll take it up on another day as well.
All right, I think Mr. Smaller, even on that issue, I think during our oversight we'll be visiting the Consumer Commission itself. I think some of the questions we must raise with them direct, because those are the guys who will be implementing that aspect. I think that question is important, because usually when you go to those liquidations, the consumers, they tend to lose big. Is there any question which is still outstanding for response?
Yes, thank you for those inputs, Chair and Mr. Smart. The issue of fresh produce market, the proof of sale to assist the South African Police Services. The question that has been raised, I must say, is a very important one. We had lots of debates around it. We had to balance the interests, obviously, and look as to the practicality of requiring everyone. And to answer that specific question directly, we said that other means of proving a case before a court of law are still applicable. It is not only documentary evidence. That's our debate at the time, and which I'm just narrating here. just to indicate what our thoughts had been at the time, that other methods of proving whether someone has committed an offense, such as oral evidence and so on, and witnesses and so on, circumstantial evidence and so on, would still be applicable. And therefore, we do not think that, and then we have to balance that with the practicality of a fruit vendor who has to sell piece by piece, receipt by receipt. And if you look at the Act, the requirements are onerous. There's a list of about 8 things that you must disclose: your name, your VAT, your date, and so on, that you have to write. Then we're taking these people out of business in a way. And then we felt that for purposes of prosecuting criminal cases, other forms of evidence will still be useful. And just to keep these people in the market, we should make this kind of sort of concession or lenience, just in respect of hawkers, and hope that other means of providing evidence would still be useful. Yeah, but there's the issue of the chair or about the tire repair. Again, I can deal with this under false advertising and so on and fraudulent schemes. But again, it doesn't even look like a fraudulent scheme under Section 42. It does actually smack of a fraudulent criminal conduct. If you say you're selling me this and it's not this but it's something else and I suffer prejudice, that is the classic textbook definition of a fraud: unlawful intentional misrepresentation of fact that results in prejudice of another person. And for me, if you're selling a tie of 2009, it's actually a tie of 2006 with no treads, it's a case of fraud, it would seem, as far as I understand the question. Because Section 42 actually captures scams like I discussed earlier with the Honorable Advocate. So, you know, there must be sort of a process, not the Honorable Advocate, I think Honorable Tabazo, that there must be a process, you know, that a certain person sets in motion to deceive another person. So, I think I'll stop there, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Just think, I think that covered all the sort of detailed question. In general, there was the question asked about the consumer awareness issue. And as I said, the mandate of the Consumer Commission was a core part of its mandate is the question of consumer awareness. We've also given them some of our EU funding just to embark on this campaign of consumer awareness. So they've been through quite a few provinces already, going into the townships. And as I said, if there's any request that members have for the Consumer Commission to assist with setting up forums, doing that, or asking the availability to present on the Act or for the Department, we're putting resources aside to be able to provide that. Because as you know, this is a new piece of legislation, both for companies and for consumers, and clearly this is one right which I think consumers have long been sort of clamoring for. So we've got resources available. We've set aside resources for consumer awareness. Also, as you know, the consumer is now up and running, and the first cases are coming in. And also, as the regulations are put into place, we're learning as we're going along. For example, there's been one of the biggest industries that the complaints came in was in terms of the cell phones, everything. So again, there the Consumer Commission is now intervening with the industry, and they are obviously improving their practices and so on. We've also had big queries from the motor vehicle repairs. We've also had from the metros, and especially the billing system and those problems in Joburg and so on. So, I mean, the regulations are now, in a sense, being tested in practice, and as I said, we're learning as we go along. And I think that in these engagements, we take into account the points we make. And as I said, in a year's time, if we review the regulations, we can then update them. And that's why, as I said, because regulations is the most flexible part of the legislation, in the sense that the minister can issue it, And then, as I said, it can be revised as we go along and as we learn about the implementation.
Thank you, DG. Honourable members, we are supposed to have had a tea break around 11. But looking at the program we have here in front of us, we could finish. Are there any outstanding questions? Let us find any indication. Because sometimes we can go for a tea break and only come for one question. Are there any members who are interested in any questions? How many are there? Or is only Honourable Smiley? I think that we can deal with that question and then break after that. Honourable Smiley.
Chairperson, I think one of the other questions that I wanted to touch on was on the consumer side, was on the Regulation 9 and 10, which talk about the keeping of information for a period of 3 years, and what happens then. Can he do what he wants, you know? Can he extend it, or does he got to discard that information? Just clarity on that. And then also to touch on I just read this morning in the business sector about Standard Bank's regulation, because this will probably be part on the consumers, was it's cancellations of contracts like your house. I had 20 years to pay, suddenly I've got money and I want to say it's done, or my vehicle. And then the deciding factor to look, you got your formula right in the pyramid scheme. I do understand that, but I also do believe that consumers are being ripped off in one way or another, especially when they want to do the cancellation of the financial sector's contracts. If you did touch on it, it would be great. We don't have got to go in detail. I just needed to understand that it's somewhere covered, and it will be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that one is the issue of the settlement. Yeah. It's a settlement, it's not a cancellation. Because when you cancel, it's when you're defaulting. Let's say you bought a 1 million house, you only paid 100,000. Now you have all the money to pay off the bond instead of a 20-year period, which is going to incur a lot of interest. I think that issue of the settlement, because somehow they tend to penalize you, that some interest is going to be built even if you are going to settle earlier. I think that one is very critical, that question. I think the other question which was raised by Mr. Mabasa was the issue of the tow trucks, the vulnerability of the consumers at the spot of the accident. Because usually when we are on N2, the accident is there, the first available tow truck to remove that car is the one who's going to take it, but without telling you that how much you're going to have for storage fees, how valid is that contract? Because we didn't agree to that, we have no choice. No. We had to remove the car. And then on the issue of the grey goods, I think that we need a better definition and engagement around that. No. Please, we need a better, because what is going to happen, I have an example of a cement here. You go get a bagger for cement here, which is important somewhere, but when you mix up, after you've finished building, you find that it does not hold the wall, it starts crumbling. Was that grey good? Was that, really? I think that one must be dealt with. All right, I'll check Mr. Smiley and Mr. Silau, and then let's close, please.
Chair, when you brought up something just came up. Now, it was about not charging a inspection fee on that regard. And I wanted to understand, in the automobile society where you take your vehicle either for repairs in a garage or into a bigger repair shop, there is a fee before, because in order to look at the extent of your vehicle accident, they've got to maybe take certain parts apart and these extended. I just wanted to understand, does that exclude that part of the sector? Because how does that one take for consideration? I'll take you a good example. I took my vehicle a month and a half ago in, and I said, just please go through my vehicle and say if there's anything wrong. They said, yes, I will do that, 850 rand. That was a simple, just a request, but that was the fee there up front. It was disclosed, I'm fine with that, and then you agreed to it. But I just would understand if a panel beater comes and look at your vehicle, you might get an account to say inspection fee 2,000 rand, obviously to determine the cost of the thing, you know, is that open or not?
That's two easy ones, Chairperson. The one is on Regulation 18. Regulation 18 on auctions. Is there any way of protecting the consumer against, through auctions, purchasing the goods for the price more than the book value? Because it is possible, if not regulated, that the people can auction up and up and up and even pay double the price of the book value of the goods. The second one is the last in Regulation 41 on languages. I'm not very comfortable that out of 11 languages you can only choose two.
All right, can the department respond, please? Thanks for that one or two questions. I think let me just kick off maybe on the last issue of the languages thing. Yeah, we've debated this issue thoroughly because, as you know, as a department and as government, we really committed to promoting all the languages, all our official languages. So the approach we adopted, as was explained, we said because, in a sense, it's a new act, it's a new commission, and we wanted to get it up and running, and as you know, so what we did was we said for now, because we need to speedily get out the act, and we've got copies for everybody here, we'll make it, because the act allows a minimum of two languages. So we used the two most spoken languages, or let's say most usable languages, English and isiZulu. But we are immediately, once the commission is up and running, we will constantly extend the number of languages. I mean, for now, anybody can complain in whatever language they is, but in terms of the information, so we will take it up as soon as we're up and running. We'll do the next and the next two or three languages, and then carry on and like that. But as I said, we are committed because this is also part of the development of languages and translation services and capacity in this area. Then quickly on the issue of the issue raised on the first question about especially with regard to property, hire purchase agreements. I mean, I think what we've said is that the Consumer Act is we're trying to throw in a wide net to cover the whole of the economy, right? But we also realize that there are big differences within the economy, and different sectors require different, and some sectors need higher level of regulation than others. I mean, as I said, there's a difference between a vacuum cleaner and a property, a mortgage. So what we're saying is we're trying to cover as much with the basic minimums, but I think to allow for this discussion, I think we must have this discussion, especially because it relates to, let's say, mortgages especially. And as you know, because of the crisis in that industry, I mean, even in the U.S. now, you've got an appeals tribunal, you've got regulators you can complain to before they can repossess even, and so on. So, I mean, because these things were issued when the market was flourishing, you could get a mortgage for nothing. And now, when the market is going down, they're also very quick to take it back. So I think we can look at, enter into discussion about, because we have had this discussion with National Treasury, and in terms of the regulation of the financial sector, about having a higher level of regulation for that, those parts, and then we exempt them from the Consumer Protection Act, as we've done for the JSE. But as long as we can be satisfied that there is another authority that can take care of it, and that there is a proper regulation, so for example, with the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, the Securities and Exchange Commission was there, and we were satisfied that it was covered
that share trading was covered by that legislation, and then we said, no, okay, now you were exempted from the Act and you fall under that Act. So I think we need to follow a similar one, maybe, in I think for in terms of especially the housing market. Also, as we indicated with estate agents, because they are properly and tightly regulated under the Estate Agency Act, the Estate Agents Board Act, we've taken them out of intermediaries in this Act because they are more tightly regulated. And as you know, later in the year, we will be amending the Estate Agents Act, where we will then tighten up on regulating that market and those agents as well. So I think it's important to see it as the overarching legislation. And as we drill down, I mean, similarly with, for example, cell phone contracts, as you know, there we've got a contract that a contract must be, you can cancel a contract, and so on, but no cost. And so, but as you know now, you get contracts where you get the cell phone as part of the contract. Now, there, obviously, the industry is saying you must pay some penalty and so on, but we're obviously trying to look at what is the appropriate penalty to pay, because maybe something must be paid, but not what they want. Maybe 50% or 30% must be paid. It could be that. So, as I said, we're looking now at the sectoral level to be so that we make it sector specific. On the issue of the grey goods, I think your example is important, because one must, I know, because it's white and black and then there's grey, so it's sort of in between. So grey has this reputation of being a bit shady. So I think we must distinguish between grey goods and defective goods. Defective goods, you've got clear remedies under the Act, right? And that you can replace them, you can claim back, you can be compensated for it if the good is defective. A grey good, as was explained, is if, for example, Panasonic or IBM, they don't directly sell, or they don't have that product here in the South African market, but they've got leftovers in Japan, and you then import it from a distributor in Japan. Now, you're not covered by that marketing and warranty arrangements by the mother company. And so all we are saying, that is nothing illegal, because the person in Japan, the importer or exporter, he acquired it legally, he owns it, he's giving it to you, and it's advantageous to you because you're getting it cheap, and lots of the times you don't take things back for repairs, so you make a decision. But we always say, we make a conscious decision that when you take this, buy this cheap fridge, you can ensure that unfortunately you don't have a two-year warranty. So we always say, with grey goods, disclose to somebody that there is no repairs or there's no spare parts available for it. As you know, it happened in the auto industry as well, where some cars you can't get spare parts. We just say you must disclose that so that the person makes a conscious choice to buy or not buy that. But counterfeit goods are covered under counterfeit, and that is purely illegal, and then the common law applies. If there's misrepresentation, the common law still applies. If you tell somebody this thing is, but it's not that, or it has that quality or reliability, and it's false information, then it's still covered under the normal legislation. And so I think I'll just hand over to on that other questions.
Thank you, DJ. Thank you, Chair. The few questions that are left, I think that was a comment on the storage costs, because I had earlier indicated that the issue of those kinds of intermediaries, the consent that must be given, the cost that must be disclosed by the intermediary, and any other likely relevant, because we've got that catch-all provision when it comes to intermediary regulations. We say any other relevant information that is necessary for the consumer to make an informed decision about that particular intermediary. But, you know, when you're regulating very broadly, maybe there could be some scope for improvement. But on that specific question of tow trucks, I would say that the provisions of the regulations around intermediaries, they do cover those scenarios. Like I said, when we created or when we drafted this regulation, we had consulted with the industry and tried to identify some of the problems. Of course, you know, there could be room for improvement. Assessing the cost of repairs, the Act starts off, you look at section, I think Honorable Smiley, the Act starts with section 15, says you must not be charged for getting a quotation at all. So when you take for any diagnostic work for the repairs, you must not be charged. But you've also, if you look at, there's an exception in terms of section 15 subsection 3 of the main act. It says, unless before preparing the estimate, the service provider has disclosed the price for preparing the estimate and the consumer has approved it. That would be the only exception. But the general practice is that when you take your stuff there, you should not be charged for repairs unless you were told that the actual work of diagnosing the faults is going to be so much and you agree to that. Auctions more than the book value. I think it's one of those areas where you have to make a decision as you bid, because as you bid, you stand a chance of actually walking away with something much more expensive than the price that you actually have to pay. In a sense, it is a bit of a gamble. It's an interesting thought, I think academically maybe can be pursued further. But in a way, I'm sure some of the arguments would be it would defeat the very purpose of having an auction. Because it's a win and lose. Either the bidder, that is the consumer, wins by getting a very cheap product and then the seller loses. Or then the situation is turned upside down or reversed in that the seller gains a lot and the consumer loses. But at least the consumer, you know, we provide in the regulation, you can go and inspect and do your homework and say, okay, they are selling fridges through our advertising regulations, and therefore, you know, it's a KIC fridge. Let me just check prices. Let me assess the goods, because we provide the right to examine the goods and so on. And then you can do the homework and say, I'm not going to bid more than that. But we are not regulating it directly, except for the advertising requirement and the right to examine and so on. Because also, I think in regulating certain industries, we also very cautious of providing very stringent that's going to change the way certain businesses or actually kill certain industries. Because some people might actually be thinking, why sell products on auction if there's not a chance that I'm going to gain more? Or why buy products from an auction if it's not going to be more than the book value, that kind of thing. I think the last question, which was actually the first, was on the bank's cancellation. A settlement, yes, cancellation. Now, depending on the nature of the agreement, I am tempted to think of this as more of a credit credit agreement regulated under the National Credit Act and not necessarily under the Consumer Protection Act. But we have had some engagements with the banks over security of the property, putting aside, because here one has got to separate the agreement for credit, which is regulated under the National Credit Act, so we should not even be talking about it under the Consumer Protection Act. And the issue of the security of the house or the land and so on that the banks have raised in the past outside the credit agreement. And those are the issues that we are discussing. We have discussed previously, and the South African Reserve Bank has requested an exemption. We are assessing the exemption in respect to Section 14. But insofar as there are aspects that are not per se credit-related aspects, but the issues of security over a certain loan by a certain piece of land and so on.
All right, DG, do you have any final parting shot?
Covers the basics.
All right, thank you, Honourable Members. I think that some of these questions which have been raised and which we can still raise, we can pursue them when we do our oversight. I can make an example here, just like the question of the language, which was raised by Mr. Slau. I think that DG, when you go to the National Consumer Commission, must actually have the time frames or the timelines, because the Constitution provides that there are 11 languages in South Africa. For accessibility, really must do that. I think that when we arrive there, the Commission must be able to tell us that at least by December, we'll be having so many languages, this material being produced in so many languages, to ensure that really we leave the spirit and the letter of the Constitution of the country.
And then, honourable members, I think that we'll have to thank the department for the excellent work they have done in delivering these regulations. Is one portfolio committee which has done that. I've been to many portfolio committees in this country, in this parliament, but the one which brought the regulations into the portfolio committee to discuss them is the first for me. I've been here for more than 12 years. It's the first for me today. I think that is because of the aging of the committee plus the readiness of the department to do its job. That's why that it must be highly appreciated. I think that even we go outside, we must emphasize what is good, what the department is doing, so that South Africa can feel good, so that everyone can be happy about our country, because there are good things happening within our country. I think it's very critical. Honourable members, I think that really, as I said, that the DG and his team, we thank him a lot for all the work, but although today you will just be grudging for bringing Amagogo into into this committee, but I think we must be sensitive next time again. But really, it's critical. The value we've got money, value for money for what we, for what transpired here today. And then number two, members. I think that when you look at Mr. Mabasa, he's usually a very participative, vibrant comrade in the committee. But today he's dozing off, it's not because of boredom of what is happening here. It's because he's got something like a flu. And then once you take a flu medication, there's a lot of alcohol. You doze off. So I think he's drunk wherever he is. He must be drunk. He's seeing the double visions there. So it's not because of that. And also appreciate Mayor Ramtamai Kotli for coming in, as the chairperson announced in the apology that she'll arrive late. It is the winter time in Cape Town. And then people get sick, because the weather changes like no other person's business. And also thank Mr. Khwabasa for allowing me to call him Mr. Khwabasa. for allowing us to call him by that name, although I thought that he was going to object to that. All right, members, we are having only two items left. It is the consideration of the draft minutes. We cannot consider the draft minutes. What you do, take those minutes along, read them, and then next week we come and approve them if they are the true reflection of what happened on that day. And then number two, there's also an oversight program for that oversight we're going to have in July. We're also not going to discuss that oversight. It's part of this big package we're having there. We're having a very nice oversight program. You also go and look at that. You look at that so that we put the flesh when we come back next week, so that we adopt it as the program. I think that because of... Is there any other business, Secretary? Any other announcement? No announcement. It's fine. Honourable members, thank you. I think the department is distributing this legislation, but I think that formally the meeting stays adjourned until next week. Thanks a lot for your participation.
Thank you.